stabbed. Something sweeps me up in the thought of that. The powerful visual of the knife going in. The plunge and stick. Because there would be bones and muscle and ligaments and squidgy, lumpy organs past the skin. And a blade wouldn't go in smooth, like into a plate of flan. I'm on the floor, my back to the wall. I don't care that I'm getting the white costume grimy and crushing the tool. I don't need this tutu. Juilliard has tutus. Everything is totally fine. No one knows. Sarah Beth is cursed with clown feet, so I know it's her on the other side of the curtain before she says my name. V, she goes, you dropped all your flowers. At some point I must have let the bouquets fall, because there are so many flowers scattered about, it's like someone ransacked some old lady's garden. I kind of hum from behind the wall of curtain. I'm noticing how, back here, where the audience never goes, this side of the curtain is tattered and plain. No velvet shine. No glimmer and sparkle. It's moth-eaten. It's frayed. And it smells like wet dog. My mom got me flowers just like you, Sarah Beth babbles as she searches for a gap in the curtain. I mean, not roses. Not like you have roses. I mean, I know I didn't have a solo, but it's still special that she got me flowers. Don't you think, V? The thing about Sarah Beth, who I know counts herself as my best friend now, though we've never had an out loud conversation about it, is that she doesn't know when to let me be. She doesn't understand me. Being best friends with Ori wasn't ever like this. She once found me crying in the back rehearsal room after ballet class. And maybe we were 12 then. Maybe we were 13. And she crept in, careful not to give me a scare. And she placed a hand on my back, drawing pictures along my spine, the way I liked her to during our sleepovers. What's the matter, V? She asked me. She knew that when I cried too hard, I got the hiccups. And she didn't laugh when my ribs rocked as the hiccups came. It was easy to know what was the matter, why I sobbed. Miss Willow had selected Ori to advance to point, which meant a whole new kind of training, plus separate special classes 3 times a week, and she hadn't selected me. I needed more time to strengthen my ankles, she'd said. But Ori's ankles were ready. Mine were still the wimpy spaghetti ankles of a little girl. Any other friend would have patted me on the back and assured me my time would be soon. But Ori made a promise, and she always kept her promises. She said she wouldn't go on point until the day I got to. She wouldn't wear the perfect point shoes Miss Willow had gifted her in charity, because her dad wouldn't have paid a dime for them until I had my own pink satin pair. I remember her fingers drawing down my spine. I remember her cheek on my cheek. I remember how she said, anything I do, you'll get to do too. How she said, I won't do it until Miss Willow says you're ready. I'll wait for you. She did wait. She waited 6.5 months for me and my ankles to catch up to hers. And she didn't bug me about it even once. Sarah Beth is still fumbling with the velvet. She's going off about all my roses. Apparently I have quite a lot. Because so many people came to see me. Sarah Beth, stop. I don't care about the flowers. Oh, okay. You did wonderful, V. Everybody was saying. I know. Oh yeah, of course you know. She quiets as I finger the back of the curtain. Its ugly side only I can see. Are you coming out? Tommy's here. But I thought you said you were breaking up with him. But he's here. And we've got the cast party, you know. And since it's your last show, you're a guest of honor. Every graduating senior would be a guest of supposed honor at that cast party. Sarah Beth was only a junior. I find the gap in the curtain and open it up and let her fill my arms again with all my bouquets. But as we're gathering the last of my bouquets, Sarah Beth lets out an ear-splitting squeak. She starts swatting at me with sloppy, panicked hands, like she does at the air when she sees a moth, instead of being normal and opening a window. Maybe Sarah Beth has reason to freak out a little. One of the bouquets in my arms is leaking, and it's not water. What's coming out the bottom end of the carefully wrapped bouquet is brilliant, red and thick, like lukewarm syrup. It seeps and smears and screams all down the front of me, congealing on my white tights. The bouquet is bleeding. It's bleeding all over me. With horror, I tilt my neck and look down. My eyes aren't sure what they're seeing at first, and then the picture sharpens, and my brain makes sense of it. There, in my arms, stuffed into delicate pink tissue paper, is a bouquet of disgusting trash. Balled up tissues and a few rags, and what looks like a guy's old white t-shirt, ripped into shreds, but fruit of the loom still on the decapitated collar. All covered, soaked, sopping, really, with blood. My arms go loose, and the bloody bouquet drops, spraying its contents everywhere. A hemorrhage, a nightmare. The blood spatters and clings to the curtain. It's sticky, webbing up my fingers like with snot. Sarah Beth bent over, gagging. A glop of thick, almost black blood falls from my kneecap to the hard toe of my point shoe, and I stare at it, transfixed. I can tell by the smell it's not real blood, because I promise you don't ever forget the smell of that. "Oh my gosh," Sarah Beth squeaks. "Oh my gosh, V, oh my gosh." She lifts a bloody arm, slick and glistening, and she points a bloody finger at the floor. A card has fallen out. One of those baby-sized cards you get from the florist, but it's face down in a goopy puddle, and neither of us is making a move to pick it up. "Did someone really give you that bouquet?" Sarah Beth says. "No, I gave it to myself. What do you think? Some bitches thought it'd be funny, obviously. They can't say it to my face, so they do this." "Say what to your face?" Sarah Beth says. And I've never pitied her more for that pea brain she's carrying around and that head of marshmallow fluff than I do right now. I stare at her until she glances away, flushing. Now she remembers. This shouldn't be happening. None of this should. The girls who would have done something like this to me on my big night aren't around anymore. It doesn't connect. Because Harmony and Rachel, they're gone. Ori got rid of them. Everybody knows that. Ori got rid of them for me. And then Ori gotten rid of, too. And now I'm the only one left. The thing I can't get a grip on is how the bouquet ended up in my arms. Some bouquets were thrown at my feet, and some were handed directly to me with an embrace, a congratulations. All this took place in front of everyone. The faces blur, smiling, everyone all smiles, so it's teeth and stretched lips and sour breath, and sometimes whiffs of sucked-on mints or sneaked cigarettes. No one seemed cruel enough to present me with a bouquet filled with trick blood and grungy tissues and a sweaty gym shirt and then grin in my face and tell me congrats. No one who's still alive, anyway. Cold creeps up my back. It reminds me of how I was looking for Ori. Not the other two, only Ori. Right before I went on. How something unspoken told me she might be out there, though she's long dead. I'm not sure what I believe, but I know what the little voice in my head believes. She was here tonight, V. She came all the way here to see you. She wanted me to have the messy, explosive gift, so I wouldn't forget her. And so she wrapped it in pink paper, my favorite color. And into the pink folds, she tucked a small card. From the ground, the side of the card that we can see says, "Congratulations on this joyous day." It's white and silver. Or it once was. Like it was meant for an anniversary celebration, or a wedding. The kind of thing you get for free if you actually buy flowers. But someone had to go to the trouble to buy this card. Or at least swipe it, just to take credit. If anyone signed it, that would be on the other side, currently face down in the puddle. "Who's the card say it's from?" I ask. "I don't want to touch it," Sarah Beth says. But she sees I'm waiting for her to do just that. So, she bends, delicately, and lifts it up, warped and dripping. She turns it over and reads. Her eyes tell all. Sometimes I forget that she was there 3 years ago. Not with us, I mean, but somewhere. She did take classes at the studio like we did, even though she was back row bad, and slug-like when it came to catching on to floor routines in any up-tempo combination. We ignored her, but she was around. She'd remember. Maybe she was one of the girls who'd been shattered by it and gone around wailing backstage. I seem to remember hearing a few banshee wails when the police escorted me home. Later I hear that there was one girl who came upon the bloody scene out back behind the theater and flat out fainted, which contaminated the area. Maybe that had been Sarah Beth? Could that explain why she's attached herself to me and blocked it all out? It's funny how someone can witness the aftermath of a double murder. Like after the bodies have gone cold and the scene's gone quiet, and someone's dropped a blanket over both corpses, so all you can see are the pink feet, and that's enough to break them. She wasn't even there to see how it went down. Sarah Beth's eyes are very large, and she says, "I think," she gulps, she sniffles, "I think this is really nasty, whoever did this to you." I don't nod to agree with her. I can't. I know this is only what I deserve. "We can't go to the cast party like this, V," Sarah Beth says, assuming I'm going and she's coming with. "It looks like we both got our periods at the same time." It doesn't look like that at all. It looks like we committed a gruesome murder. And then we decorated our bodies with the blood. It looks horrific. "It's in your hair, V. Ick! It's in mine, too. We have to go shower and change. Let's go out the back way. I don't want my mom to see me like this. She'll freak." Why'd they write that on the card, anyways? Why'd they pretend to be her? Who'd be so mean? She waits for answers, like I'm some sort of psychology expert. But this is not from the girls at the studio. I'd know Ori's handwriting anywhere. I may have fooled the audience and my parents and Sarah Beth and the admissions committee at Juilliard. I mean, how wowed were they by my audition? The ballet piece I prepared for them was The Dance of the Firebird from the Igor Stravinsky masterpiece, first performed in Paris in 1910, which had been Ori's solo those 3 years ago, which I'd learned from mirroring Ori, and which I'd forever know by heart. But Ori wouldn't have been fooled for a second. She always did know me better than anyone else did. She didn't judge me, but she didn't shy away from me either. She knew what I was, and, still for some unknown reason, I'll be tossing over and over in my mind for my whole life. She stayed true to me, kept being my friend. I'm the one who turned away. Like tonight. Ori would have seen through my once white, now red-stained leotard, and the white, now red-spattered froof of my tutu, to what's inside. Not the second leotard under the first one, but deeper, under my skin. The gross parts of the person I really am. The blood and guts, the ugliness, the slimy secrets, the liar I'm hiding in there. The true person I am, tangled up with the worms and rot. Never again. The day my best friend got sent to prison, I was 100 miles away, eating cheese. That's all I like to eat on the day of an audition, for protein, for energy, and for luck. One piece of cheese in the morning, another piece an hour before, to give it time to go down the tubes and digest, and a tiny piece minutes before, gobbled up so quick I hardly bother chewing, so it gives me the last bump I need before I go on. Cheese breath doesn't matter when your muscles are warm, your feet fast, and you dance like the star you are destined to be. It was the first week of August, the summer I was 15. That was the same summer Ori spent in jail, the holding place where they kept her until she got sent to Aurora Hills. It was my first summer without her, when the hole in my life seemed too humongous to face by looking right at it. So I didn't let myself look. I was at an audition. I was eating a hunk of cheese. I was lacing the ribbons of my point shoes, knotting them neat at the back and tucking the knot in. I was humming Stravinsky, and then when that got weird, I switched to Tchaikovsky. Her life was over that summer, but mine, only just beginning. I had my legs split, stomach pressed to the floor, spine stretched as long as I could make it go. My arms were out, reaching. No one was on the other side opposite me to take my hands. I closed my eyes and did the breathing thing, the one she taught me, where I visualized myself on stage in New York City, where else, with roses at my feet. The roses at my feet, the roses at my feet. Until, finally, I was ready. I had my rituals, and I wasn't going to break them, even on the day she got shipped upstate. That was what I heard someone call it, upstate, even though we already lived pretty far up. It was like she was being sent off to a work camp in Siberia. That was how far away it felt. Way too far to ever visit. She should have been with me at the audition, slipping the bobby pins in my hair, and then I'd do hers, wrinkling her nose when I took out my cheese. Then again, if she'd been at the audition and not headed to prison, she for sure would have gotten a role. And I for sure would have been passed over, told try again next year, and there'd have been no roses at my waiting feet. I knew audition morning that it was the day they were announcing her sentencing. My parents made sure to tell me themselves. It was like they thought I'd feel better, knowing. Like I'd relax and sleep safer at night, knowing the exact number of days she'd be locked away. No one needed to tell me it was the day. I was well aware already. I streamed it on my computer during morning pliés. I saw how they put her in orange and perp walked her away. And there were details the camera caught, like how she had more makeup on her left eye than her right. And I wondered if she ran out of mascara. And then I wondered if she even had mascara in jail. And if not, what the gunk on her left eye could be. I also noticed that her thick, dark hair, which I kind of envied since it grew stick straight from her head and didn't frizz, looked now like it was thinning and bits of her scalp peeked through. I wondered if it was possible to start going bald at 15. Like, from stress. Also, she seemed kind of pale. It could have been the cameras or the orange of her outfit glaring against her skin, but she was usually nice and brown, never needing to lie out for a suntan. And now it was high summer and she looked like a ghoul. The Ori I knew, the Ori everyone knew, or used to know, was the kind of girl who seemed sure of herself no matter how she looked. She never cared as much as I did. She'd come away from sweating buckets in advanced ballet, and she'd be all glowy and dewy and full of life, like this was a tampon commercial, when all I wanted was to dunk my head in a cold sink of water and hug my knees till the shake stopped. But watching her there, live streaming on the news, I was struck by what was missing. She was just putting one foot in front of the other, and barely. Her ankles were in chains, her arms behind her back. She was stringy-haired and wonky-eyed and alarmingly gray. The news lady was talking about the details of the crime. I put her on mute. I only wanted to see Ori. Now she was pushed through a door, and she didn't look back once, and the door closed behind her, and the camera held on the shut door like we were in some kind of European film. And then the camera swiveled and swooped in on the crowd, going in close on the victim's mothers. And I shut off the picture. I finished my last set of pliés. At the audition, I sat alone, apart from the other girls, and snarfed down the cheese from my bag. Then I stood up and shook out my limbs and cracked my neck and cracked my knuckles and tried not to think of her. Didn't let myself think of her. Got my number called, took my spot, didn't think of her. Did the combination, did it spot on, did it with every step precise, didn't think of her. Didn't think of anything. Didn't even feel my own feet, which was a miracle because I had a pretty outrageous blister. I got the part, obviously. Only a role in the core, where you have to move exactly the same as everyone else and dance background, the lowest you can go in ballet, unless you're on crew, carting around the scenery. They said I got it because I had solid technique. I had the right body. I had decent feet. My extension was fine. My training up to level. I had a lot of potential. I had a future. I wanted it and worked for it. They didn't say they were overtaken by my performance, that I took their breath away, made their hearts skip a beat, that I was unforgettable, astonishing even. If Ori had danced for them, those are things they might have said, once they got their breath back. Still, I got the part. And I got it because after my best friend was sent away to Aurora Hills Secure Juvenile Detention Center, and whatever it was I needed to look at a map upstate, my luck kind of changed. My life started looking up. Everything I did was something she wouldn't get to do, so I'd have to do it one better. I'd have to be her, in a way, because it wasn't like she could be herself anymore. I didn't have her natural talent, her spark, but I was good, and people started taking notice. I couldn't help but think that by the time Ori got out, she'd be way too old, and it would be way too late. She wouldn't dance on a stage again. Ever. Days passed after the audition, and after Ori was sentenced and sent to Aurora Hills, and I made a whole list of nevers in my head. Never again would Ori build a blanket fort with me. And never again would we hide under the blanket fort like little kids. Never again would Ori paint my toenails purple to match a purple bruise. Never again would Ori do one bite, my bite, two bite, your bite, with a bowl of Cheerios. Never again would I catch Ori doing the sweet things she sometimes did for perfect strangers, and make fun of her for them, like holding doors for slow, decrepit randoms, and looking all over the neighborhood for the whiny brat's overweight dog. Never again would Ori step on a stage and wow an audience to tears. Never again would Ori shake her head and get embarrassed when they said how perfect she was, how incredible, how stunning, how transcendent. Transcendent. They actually used that word. Never again would she ask me to please stop talking about it. And never again would I say, "Did you see how they looked at you? It's like you're the next Anna Pavlova." Never again would she ask me, hours later, timid and shaky-voiced, "V, you're not feeling weird about what they said about me, are you? You'd tell me, wouldn't you?" And never again would I have to lie through my straight teeth. Hers were crooked. She really could have gotten braces. And say, "I'm okay. Don't worry about me. I'm fine." Never again. I did plan to visit her up there. Someday. And I did plan to write her back. Sometime. I was thinking about what I'd say to her, since my attorney pulled me away after and told me not to speak a word to her. Not about the charges, but about anything at all. I knew we'd have a chance to talk one day. We had to. But I guess I wasn't done with the never agains. Because never again would Ori see me. And never would I see Ori. We wouldn't get to exchange a hello or goodbye. Or do you want a piece of cheese? Or I like your leotard. Can I borrow it ever again? I wouldn't get to look into her eyes and see if she hated me. If she deep down despised me. If she dreamed of getting out and murdering me with an axe or a gun point blank at my temple. Or if she'd choose to shoot me in the back like cowards in old westerns got to make someone die. If she dreamed of doing to me what I woke up, sweating, flailing, heart-pounding, dreaming she'd already done. The worst was this. Never again would I get to see Ori alive. I will always remember where I was the day she got sent to Aurora Hills. The audition. Doing my cheese ritual. Snagging that role in the Corps. But I don't know where I was when she, and all those other girls with her, died. I wouldn't have been back in school yet, because it was still August. Probably I was at the ballet studio, because where else would I have been? Testing out the limits of my body, as I like to when I have the studio to myself. Trying to perfect a step, or get my leaps to go even higher, or my split to go down even farther. Or trying for a triple pirouette, because I hadn't mastered that yet. But soon I would. Our ballet studio's spring showcase had been postponed that year, as anyone would have expected after losing 3 featured dancers in the cast. But when I took the stage at some point that summer as the Firebird, the role that had originally been hers, I was better than anyone expected. My costume wasn't as elaborate as hers had been, but I was enchanting, I heard someone say. Unforgettable. I could have been doing any number of ordinary things the day she died. Taking my second or third shower of the day. Breaking in a new pair of point shoes. Watching old Bolshoi performances on YouTube. Sitting through another meal with my parents. Then going up to the bar and stalled in my suite to work it off after. Draining my toe blisters. Cleaning my room. All I know is that I wasn't thinking of her. I kept myself busy to make sure. My mother and father were the ones who gave me the news. Together, one weekend on the white couch in the living room, even though we didn't ever sit on that couch or go in that room, unless we had the excuse of company. I heard odd phrases, confusing patches of sentences that didn't connect to anything, so I had to piece the whole truth together later, from a few choice Google searches. Mass poisoning, my father said. The Lord works in mysterious ways. My mother said. I'm sure there was a lot of vomiting. Honey, do you need some water? Right near the falls, such lovely wine country. Why, yes, dear, some of them were gangerbangers, or is it gangbangers? 42 dead. 42 girls. Suicide pact, you'd expect. No one knows for sure. How about some pâté for lunch? That last bit was my mother. And because I didn't see it for myself, I don't think I let myself believe. She was in that place not even a month. She couldn't be gone for good. I still hadn't come to visit. I turned 16 that fall after Ori died. And that was the year I danced the part of Odette in our school's showcase at the community theater. And I felt fine. I turned 17 the following fall and danced the part of Giselle, which would have been a feat if John hadn't dropped me during our pas de deux, and the audience hushed to a deadening silence. And I tried not to think how that's what she hears, now, every day. I still felt fine. I turned 18, she'd never get to. I felt fine. I auditioned for 2 summer intensives, and for a few repertory companies, to be a trainee. Had some hiccups, some bad luck. Some morons not letting me in. But then I saw the call for Juilliard auditions. The school was known for not just ballet, but contemporary, which made my coach say it wasn't the ideal fit. But there was something that spoke to me. Ori, maybe. Ori's eyes I was seeing through. So I tried to channel her. I tried to be her on the dance floor. I expanded my practice hours. I doubled up on my cubes of cheese. Even though I hadn't danced the role of the Firebird since I was 15, That was what I chose to embody for the solo I prepared for the Juilliard audition. I danced what haunted me. I owed her this acknowledgement. Whenever I practiced it, in the studio or at home, with my coach adjusting me, or all alone in the mirror, I felt her there with me, shadowing my every move. I felt her inside me sometimes. She breathed when I breathed. Her body stretched when mine stretched. I felt the blisters on her toes pop when mine popped. When I got in, it's like we both got in. The months went on. Had a little scare with Achilles tendonitis, but I got over it. It wasn't so bad. I felt fine. Started hooking up with John, dumped him, felt fine. Ended up with Tommy, who didn't even study ballet, which was fine. Let Sarah Beth from our ballet studio hang around. Let her think we were best friends. Graduated high school. GPA perfectly fine. Summer started, my last summer at home. Knew I'd get around to dumping Tommy sooner or later. Let life happen, I guess. And in between, practiced at the bar every day. Looked in the mirror every day to see if I looked okay. If I looked fine. Because what's inside is getting harder to hide. After my standing ovation and the bouquet full of blood that had me and Sarah Beth sneaking out of the theater and going back to my house to change before the cast party, I find myself doing it again. Looking. I've washed my face for the third time and lifted up my neck, dripping, to study myself in the mirror. At first, I look decent. Wet. But fine. Then I see it. There's a speck of red I didn't catch. A droplet of fake blood on my earlobe. I wipe it off and take a taste of my finger like candy. Sarah Beth hovers in the doorway. V, do you have any clothes I could borrow? You can wear whatever's in the tall dresser, or what's on the left side of the closet. That's the stuff I'm not taking with me. She waits. It's like she's afraid or something. And just go ahead and keep it, I say. Whatever it is. Really? You're sure? Keep whatever you want. I'm never coming back. I feel it. Her face creases. Okay, I don't know what'll fit me, but okay. She drifts out of sight. And then I look again in the mirror to see if the guilt is written all over my face. No matter how many times I wash it, I keep seeing red. We're not going to the cast party, are we? She calls. Nah, I say, even though I know my parents are there. My coaches are there. Miss Willow, who's been my instructor all these years, is there. My mother's called twice already, and I'm waiting for her to call again. I wash my face one more time. When I come out from the bathroom, Sarah Beth's been digging in my closet and has a take pile started on the floor. It happens in slow motion. When she reaches up to remove a shirt from the hanger and the sleeve gets caught on the shelf above, she gives a tug, and that's the jolt that does it. It drops from the heights of the walk-in closet directly onto me, its sharp, pointy end striking me between the eyes, dead on, like there's some red-circled target on me I wasn't able to wash off with soap. I'm down now, on the carpeted floor of the walk-in closet, on my knees. The gaudy red costume feather crushed in my hand, and I see another trace of her, though I was so sure I'd gotten rid of them all. But there, lined up with all the old pairs of point shoes I'd crashed through, worn out, grown out of, broken a little, broken clean in half, got bored of, spilled cola on, their shredded toes, their blackened bottoms, their scraggly ribbons, there. A pair of hers I missed. I know they're hers because of the initials marked on the inside of the satin sheath. Not V-A-D for Violet Allegra Dumont. I always use my middle initial so no one can say I have V-D on my toe shoes. Ori copied me and used hers too. O-C-S. That's what it says on the satin. O for Oriana, C for Catherine, S for Spearling. blood pulsing in my arms, blood pounding in my head. I remove a shoe and hold it. The box has been softened to mush, the ribbons are frayed, and the satin on the bottom of the toe, where it touches the floor, is peeled open. It smells dreadful, like it's been rotting 6 feet underground for years. The shank, the hard bottom piece that runs along the sole, has been cut 3/4 of the way down with a box cutter to give the shoes new life after the shanks got broken from dancing, which happens. Ori and I read about this shanking method online. How real-life ballerinas adjust their shoes so they can use them for longer. Ori didn't have the money to keep buying new pairs, and she felt funny when I tricked my parents into paying for hers, so we'd make these adjustments. She'd hold the shoe steady for the operation. I'd slice. And it's the cut that sends me back. I can see the ridge, the line we made with the Sharpie, the deep carving. I can remember the feel of the box cutter in my hand. We were in the studio's dressing room, the two of us in a corner, and the others, a whole group of them, were hissing and laughing across the way. I made a deep, straight cut, and I wanted to ask her, "Why are you here with me? Why aren't you with them, over there?" I sliced too hard, with too much force, and nipped my finger. She wrapped a tourniquet of tissue around my injured hand, and a drop of my blood got on her tights. The tiniest fleck. But that was later, closer to the end. She could have chosen anybody, but I had nobody in the beginning, and she wanted somebody even if she didn't know it. The moment was cemented one evening, early on in our ballet training, when no one came to pick her up when class was over. My mother was inside, discussing making a donation to the dance studio, as she would begin to do each year, and she told me to wait out front in the car. Instead, I'd gone wandering. That was when I spotted the girl from class. The one with the very, very long hair, like no one ever took her to get it cut at a salon, and her funny, made-up-sounding name, Oriana, like two names squashed together. We got to talking. We were about 8 years old then, I'd say. Even then, I had ideas. "I'm going to be a prima ballerina someday," I told her. It was something I used to tell everyone back then, until it became so obvious years later, and everyone started telling me. "You will," she said. She didn't announce that she was, too. "I'm going to be famous. I write it down every night, so in the morning it knows to come true." "That's a good idea," she said. "What about you?" She looked at me oddly, and now it hangs heavy over me. Like even then she knew she had no future. "I don't know yet," was all she said. She checked the parking lot again. No cars were slowing on the road. "He's not coming," she said. "Probably he forgot." "Come on," I said, and I took her hand. I had no siblings, no close friends at school, no one I touched like this before. Apart from my parents when they used to make me hold on to them when crossing a street. Her palm was thin and felt so soft. Her skin was cool, like she never got sweaty. She let me pull for a moment, and she didn't stand up, so I thought she wouldn't come with me, and I was about to let go. Then she stood, and my hand was in her hand, and we went running. A brown car shrieked over the curb, coming to a hard stop right before us, and almost clipping our legs, ending our dance careers before they even got started. It wasn't her dad. The driver honked at us, blasting his horn and yelling out the window. What were we trying to do? Kill ourselves and everyone around us? But we were children then, and we were just figuring out how to live. The car finished its U-turn and headed back to the road. I laughed. I believed in writing down my future, but I didn't know to keep an eye on hers. I led my new friend to my mom's car, and I opened the door and showed her to the back seat. "Come on," I said. "Get in." I still wonder what would have happened if that car had hit us, or if her dad had showed up on time, or if she hadn't climbed into the back seat and we hadn't ended up taking her home. Now she's gone. I'm in my bedroom with Sarah Beth 10 years later, and I turn and I swear. It's like Ori's back in the room. Lounging out on my bed behind me, a waterfall of dark, pin-straight hair, muscled legs, and blazing toe blisters. The awareness of her is back. The loss of her is back. The heavy weight of what was done, too, is back, in my bed, and I'll have to sleep with it every night until I do something and face what I've done. I never visited her. Never had the chance. Ask me, and that's what I'll say to the question. The truth is, even if I'd had the chance, even if there hadn't been that freak accident, or suicide pact, or bad batch of dinner in the cafeteria that offed the whole population less than a month after she got put away, I'm not sure I would have gone to visit her behind bars. What would I have said? What would it have looked like, that reunion? I heard about Aurora Hills. It's closed now. Vandals have had their way with it. I read that somewhere online. Graffiti and broken windows, and fires set in the hallways. People who knew the girl prisoners who died are drawn to the gate outside Aurora Hills, down at the bottom of the hill. There is a photo on some website. That's how I know. Family members go there, friends, sometimes the curious, or a morbid freak who gets hot off the idea of all those dead girls. It's August now, the third summer, and soon people will be gathering to remember. I have an urge that's sudden. I want to get up there before the families do, before the candles and the singing and the prayers, before the anniversary, before August 30th. Before I leave for New York City. I can see it now. And that pile of rotting stuffed bear corpses I saw online. Bow-tied bears and fairy bears and chubster bears and puny baby bears. The runts no one wanted. At the gate with the bears and the cards poorly drawn by children at some demented elementary school. And the flowers. The mass grave of rotting flowers. Yeah. Down somewhere and all that. Dug in deep. I might have to leave a little something. There's nowhere else to do it. She wasn't buried in a cemetery, so there's no grave to visit. Her dad had her cremated, right before he moved away. Sarah Beth is hovering over me, bug-eyed. I barely have to turn to let her know I'm speaking to her now. You up for a little road trip? How long a drive? I get carsick. Can I pick the music? She starts, but then she gets it. My hand has come open, and the bright crimson-dyed feather is visible on my palm. Does she remember? I do. It's from the headpiece of the Firebird costume, the last costume Ori ever wore, and the last connecting link between her and me. Ori's telling me it's not something I'll be able to put away and forget, like I tried to do with her. Never again, she's saying. Never again. The hole in the fence. It's the next day, and I get Tommy to drive. He'll be over soon. Sarah Beth assures me she's coming, even though she gets carsick and I won't let her pick the music, and we have to wait to leave until after she gets off work. Then she wants to borrow a sweater because she's cold, constantly, even in summer. And I tell her to see what's left in the tall dresser. Then we have to make up a story for my parents, and it's already afternoon by the time we go downstairs to meet Tommy, who's parked outside, but doesn't want to come in for some reason he won't say. Sarah Beth and I head down and spot his car at the curb. But it's empty. We find him in the rock garden, directly below my bedroom, like he's keeping tabs on me. He's not alone. Tommy's leaning against the lattice and kind of gives me a nod when I approach, which isn't his usual. Maybe I should have texted him back after the showcase last night, But the shape lurking in the windows behind Tommy is what makes me grab for a hold of the wall to steady myself. I can't let them see that, though, so I act like I've got an itch on my ankle. I scratch a few times and straighten up. "Miles," I say, nodding. Just look who it is. Ori's Miles, the one and only. All in black, surprise, and sporting his usual cowlick, like he doesn't own a hairbrush to his name. Years have passed since I last had to look at him, and he seems taller now, scowlier. He nods back, doesn't meet my eyes. No hello. I look between Miles and Tommy, Tommy and Miles. What, they're buddies now? Where Tommy goes, Miles goes too? Tommy won't meet my eyes. His gaze holds steady on my feet. It's summer and I'm in sandals, though my toes are completely covered. He knows I hate when he looks too closely at my feet. His ball cap is on backward, begging for an adjustment, and there's something like moss growing on his cheeks, which I realize, with dull horror, is his attempt at growing a beard. Ballet dancers never have beards. "Hi, Tommy. Hi, Miles. I didn't know you were coming," Sarah Beth says, ever oblivious. "Tommy?" I want his explanation. I want him to tell me why he's brought that kid here to my property tonight, letting him tag along on our drive up to the prison, which is my personal expedition and nothing to do with anybody else, apart from Tommy being the one to drive because I already sold my car, and Sarah Beth can't use her parents' SUV. I told him it was private, none of his business. And his response was to invite Ori's ex? Tommy pulls me aside against the lattice, so we can have a moment alone. I think he's going to stutter out an apology, maybe, try to explain. But no. He gives me a kiss, and I wonder if it's hit him yet. That I have so many important things all about to start happening for me, and I'm not going to spend any time looking backward. Does he get that? There are things he doesn't ask of me, ever. Like, are we breaking up or what? Or even, hey, weren't you best friends with a convicted murderer? And weren't you a witness on the case? And didn't she die in some bizarre poisoning? And now, suddenly, you want to go visit the scene of the accident? And hey, what's up with that? Nothing. The boy has asked me nothing. I give him a little shove so he gets his scratchy face away from mine. What is he doing here? Out of the corner of my eye, I notice Sarah Beth smiling and attempting to make small talk with Miles. And I'll have to set her straight on who we're speaking to later. I asked him to come, Tommy says. Why? I say dully. He knows how to find the place. He's been up there before, you know. There's GPS on your phone. Tommy gets defensive. You'd think his loyalties are all with Miles instead of with me. Miles wants to see her too, Tommy goes. And I'm like, we're not seeing anybody. She's not there to see. Then he's like, doesn't Miles deserve to come because he wrote her letters? And he even visited her up there one time with his stepdad before she died. And I never got on her visiting list, did I? This is the most Tommy has ever said on the subject of Oriana Spearling, who he didn't even know when she was alive. I had no idea he had this much information. I zip my mouth, keep it in. Fine, Tommy. Let's just go then. I snap my fingers at Sarah Beth, causing her to step on a rock sideways and flail and fumble, the graceful thing that she is. Miles smirks. He heads for the curb, opening the garden gate without having to search around for the hidden latch first, because he knows where it's hiding. He used to come here all the time, but never to see me. Maybe that was when things shifted, between Ori and me. She got with Miles, for no good reason I could put a finger on, and she wasn't always around like she'd been before him. Ori used to peek out the window and communicate with him. They had a set of hand signals, one she never shared with me. And then she'd turn to me, in my bedroom, and she'd say, "Miles just wants to talk. I'm going down for a few minutes." At some point between slipping on a pair of shoes and finding a hoodie, she'd pause. Then she'd have to say it, because this was my house. "Want to come with?" Of course, I never wanted to go down there and watch her make out with him on my patio furniture. "Nah," I'd say. "Go, I'll be fine." She'd tiptoe back up my staircase after I stopped waiting for her. She'd slip in under the covers because by then I'd be in bed, making my breaths even so it seemed like I was asleep. She'd whisper my name, but it'd be a quiet whisper, half-hearted. She'd sigh. She'd flop over a few times on the mattress, shuffle the pillows, try to get comfortable. Then she'd sigh again, and I'd hear it. I couldn't not hear it. It would fill up the room in the dark night, the contented sigh of her happiness. I kept my eyes closed. "Let's go," I say. We all head for Tommy's ridiculous green car, with the two big tires and the white racing stripe. Before I can call out a claim for it, Miles is taking shotgun, and I have to squeeze in the tight back seat with Sarah Beth, who's reminding us she might get a little queasy, and it's no big deal. But if she asks Tommy to pull over, that's why. Miles sits face forward playing with his phone. That was how I found out about him and Ori in the first place. Those text messages he was sending, and the messages she was sending back. She was trying to hide it from me, as if I wouldn't like it. She was right. "You good up there?" I call out to Miles. "Got enough room to stretch your legs?" The driver's seat is wedged into my knees, so I sure don't. Miles doesn't respond. He doesn't need to. The seething hatred coming off him is so strong. I half expect the windows to fog over, frogs to rain down, a crack to open up in the cul-de-sac and take me. And maybe after that, a tornado. As we start moving, I feel, distantly, a spot of warmth on my body. I realize it's Sarah Beth's hand. She is patting my arm. I think she's trying to comfort me. It brings me back. Not to any warm and shimmering memory between me and Sarah Beth. She's nothing to me. More to a warm hand on my shoulder. Two warm hands. If Ori were here, she'd tell me to ignore him. She'd shove her head between the two front seats and demand that he be nice to me. Why? Because she said. Then again, the thought of Ori being here and not nowhere, which is where she is, makes my conscience rumble. She didn't like it when people were mean to me. Way back when we were girls, she could have slipped into any of the cliques at our dance studio and stalked off, smiling. It could have been Harmony, Rachel, and Oriana. Or Harmony and Oriana, with Rachel kicked to the curb. And maybe Harmony would have been the one to start calling her Ori. I wouldn't have known her, apart from having to stand next to her at the bar to do demonstrations, or sometimes sharing the floor during a group combination and avoiding her kicks to the shins. But she chose me, and only me. Maybe because she saw no one else had. She had a way of seeking out the weirdo, like she wanted to be some kind of protector. The outcast no one else was conversing with, she'd go over and sit next to, make it less awkward for everyone. Help that freak feel less alone. Look at Miles. He was a nobody she plucked from nothingness. I glare at him in the passenger seat, narrow my eyes, thinking this. Until the thought about faces, and I realize what it might say. Out of everyone Ori could have been friends with, charity cases and otherwise, she zeroed in on me. The drive isn't so long. The way I've acted, anyone would have thought the detention center was days and days away, practically in another country. It's up north near Lake Ontario and the Canadian border. Sure, but we don't live so far from the border ourselves. At most, if Tommy follows the speed limit, the drive is 3 hours, a day trip closer than Niagara Falls.
You shouldn't be wearing that, Miles says, from out of nowhere.
These are the first words he's spoken in nearly an hour, since we left my cul-de-sac and hit I-90. His words aren't aimed at me, but at Sarah Beth, who he must know from school, since they both go to public. She turns crimson. It's what she does at the slightest push. When we're doing bar work and Miss Willow adjusts Sarah Beth's arms or makes a microscopic correction to her turnout, Sarah Beth's cheeks flame. Her freckles pop like blood spatter. The only things not reddened on her whole body will be her hands, her feet, and the very tip of her nose. It's here, I remember, randomly, for the first time in forever, that I used to call her Rooster, though Ori didn't seem to like when I did. What? Why? Sarah Beth says. What's wrong with what I'm wearing? I get it before she does. Miles only means the sweater she has on, borrowed from my room. It's striped and has a hood. Orange stripes, yellow stripes, blue stripes, green stripes, a black stripe here and there. It was a revolting number of colors to wear at once, and of course it wasn't mine. It was Ori's. Another thing of hers still mingled with the stuff in my room. Miles would remember that sweater. He'd remember Ori in it. He did seem like the kind of boyfriend who paid attention. He means your sweater, I tell Sarah Beth. Oh, she says. It's not mine, it's V's. Miles' gaze lifts to my face. This is the first time he's met my eyes. It's not yours, it's hers. Did you steal it from her before or after you got her sent to prison? I'm thrown for a loop. But then Tommy blasts the horn like there's a deer in the road. Except there is no deer. There's only me now. Ori's not coming back. She's never coming back. She's gone. And Miles is right. I did do that. Who cares whose shirt is whose? Tommy shouts. Miles, is this the exit? And this draws Miles' attention back to the highway, to where we're headed, to the gate, the shrine for the girls who never got out. I need to see it for myself before I move on. I know we won't be able to get near the building where she was held. There are gates and chains and everything is all locked up. And we're not trespassing and getting ourselves arrested. Because I've got Juilliard in a week. But maybe we'll see a guard tower, some barbed wire, something connected to her, something. Will that be enough? We exit the first highway for a second highway, then finally swerve off all highways onto a wooded, increasingly narrow road. The place isn't at all familiar, but it's also everything I thought it would be. There are bumps and pits in the badly paved road, so my stomach lurches up to my throat, and Sarah Beth hangs her head to her knees, saying she's queasy. We're going up and up on a steady incline, but too many trees are in the way to see where. The sky is smaller above us as the trees close in, and then the sky is cut out completely. We're close. I get a chill. I almost want to ask for the sweater back. Other than that, I feel nothing. We pass an old street sign, bent over and shrouded in hanging leaves. It says, Prison Area. Do not pick up hitchhikers. I still feel nothing. Miles is the one who tells us where to stop before the gate is even in sight. He really has been here before. Tommy's not sure where to park his car. He's so precious about the paint job and doesn't want any passing cars to swipe it. But it's not like there's a parking lot here to welcome visitors. It's not like there's valet service. Soon I'm standing in the back.